Our show is supported by Be My Guest with Ina Garten, Ina's official podcast from Food Network, back for its fourth season. On every episode, Ina invites a different friend to her home in the Hamptons to talk about life, love, and career, all while cooking up an amazing meal. Join Ina as she crafts a classic cocktail with journalist Frank Bruni and discusses the ins and outs of Yorkshire pudding with actress Emily Mortimer. If you're looking for great conversations about and over good food, tune in to Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts.
It's the Splendid Table from APM American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. When I was debating about taking my first food job, a friend said, "I don't know anything about food, but I think it might be like the fingers of your hand. It could take you down a lot of different paths." Well, today we're on those paths with two exceptional chefs. Now, they seem quite unlike each other, at least at first glance. We've got the consummate French master, Jacques Pepin, and the innovator from India, Vikas Khanna. Stay with us for the making of two chefs and much more this hour on The Splendid Table. This is The Splendid Table from APM American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Let's go back to the age of Aquarius. Now, that was the 60s and the 70s when the American food revolution erupted. A young French chef was pretty near the forefront. Now, I don't think he knew it at the time. He was Jacques Pepin. And my first memory of Jacques was him demonstrating in a department store in Brooklyn. He'd pick up a knife and everybody would sigh. During his breaks, he'd come upstairs and make omelets for the staff, and he just charmed us. I mean, we thought he was the hottest thing on two legs, and his food was pretty swell, too. Well, Jacques now has full master status as a culinary groundbreaker, a TV star, and a consummate teacher. He joins us with his 26th book. It's called Essential Pepin, More Than 700 All-Time Favorites from My Life in Food. Jacques, it's good to have you back with us.
Delighted to be here.
You know, I'd like to talk about that time, going back to when you first came to the United States, because you were there when this immense interest in food began. And it began on both coasts. I mean, it began in New York City, and you were in the midst of it. So you started out in New York in the 1960s.
Right.
At that time, who impressed you the most, and what impressed you the most?
Well, certainly the first time I went in a supermarket was in America. Supermarket did not exist in France, and I thought it was kind of nifty to have one place where you could buy everything instead of going to the fishmonger and the vegetable and to get your milk in one place, and everything was there. I was, however, surprised of the amount of packaging and not that much vegetable. Great meat, I mean, terrific beef, lamb, lobster, but one salad, iceberg, that's it. No leek, no shallot, no oriental vegetable, no oil and different vinegar and all that stuff did not exist. So it was different, but exciting at the same time. I mean, I came here in September 1959, and by next year, well, Craig Claiborne was at the New York Times, just started, and came to the Pavilion where I was working to do a piece. And I became friends with Craig, and Craig introduced me to Helen McCullough, the food editor of McCall and House Beautiful after. And she kind of became my surrogate mother. And Helen spoke with James Beard on the telephone like 2 hours every day about the whole food world. So through Helen, I met James Beard. And then a few weeks later, or a few months later, rather, in spring 1960 or something like that, she said, can you look at that manuscript? I have a manuscript here to review, and I think it's pretty good. And I look, and I said, shit, this is pretty good. And she said, well, the woman is from California. She's going to come next week. Let's cook for her. I mean, she's a very big woman with a terrible voice. And, of course, that was Julia. So my point is that the trinity of cooking, if you want, which was Julia Child and James Beard and, of course, Craig Claiborne, I knew those people within like 6-8 months that I was here. So that shows you how small the food world was.
The thing, too, you mentioned in a conversation we had, that coming from France, you were used to a class system where a chef would not have had the kind of freedom that you had here in the United States.
Oh, yeah, without any question, it extends more than to the chef. I mean, the social class were quite different. I mean, I remember in France working in big restaurant or big hotel, Plaza Athénée, Maxime, Fouquet's in Paris, and the cooking was pretty rigid, you know, and organized and disciplined. Certainly at the Plaza Athénée, we cut the tomato one way, and I never even questioned it. That was the way things were. And that's what happened for us, for me, certainly, with Nouvelle Cuisine. All of a sudden, I cut the tomato in the other direction and did other things. And that was certainly Nouvelle for me, or for people like André Saltner or Alain Seyac, people my age, because we had known what it was before. Mm-hmm. For most of the people, those were not Nouvelle Cuisine. This is the way they learned, and that's the way it was, period.
How do you think the American palate has changed?
Well, this is an impossible question. You know, on one hand, there is a dichotomy that often for the European, they look at American who basically eat five dish, and that's hot dog, hamburger, you know, fried chicken, pizza, and I don't know, canned macaroni or whatever. And to a certain extent, there is truth in there. You know, when you go to the mall crowd, if you want, people who are there eat those dish over and over, and that's what they eat. So in that context, the spectrum of taste is going to be shorter than for most European. However, conversely, you go into, all over the country now, certainly, but I mean, New York, San Francisco, the big town, the diversity of food is much larger than it would be in any European country because it's America, and that's the way it is. In France, we eat 99.9% French, and in Italy, you eat 99.99% Italian, and in Germany as well, or Switzerland. But in America, no, that's the whole point. So in that context, the spectrum of taste is much larger than most European, which often Europeans don't realize, of course.
Yeah, and it's interesting, too, because done well, each one of those five dishes you talked about are also brilliant dishes.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I teach at Boston University for 29 years and at the French Culinary Institute in New York here. And, you know, young chefs, they get all excited. They want to do something very complicated by this. They want to do like a big caramel cage.
Something very fancy.
Or something fancy and esoteric and different and all that. So what are we going to do? Today I say, okay, why don't we make a hot dog today, a lobster roll and a BLT? People say, are you kidding or what? I say, no, see, that's the whole point. You have to go in depth. There is always a better way of doing it. There is a better way of doing anything, and this is why you'll go to that place and say, I never had a hot dog like in that place. I mean, the bread that they had, type of hot dog, the mustard, the way it's cooked, whatever it is, but mm-hmm. you can go always in depth and have it better, and you will remember that, and you remember a great hamburger or a great piece of chicken or anything else. So you don't have to be complicated. You can, as I say, always work in depth, you know.
I must say, you rarely say, I'll never forget that anchovy foam.
Yeah, that's true.
Jacques, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure to be on your show.
Jacques Pepin's author of Essential Pepin. Now, true to Jacques' love of simplicity, try his bread and onion soup. The recipe's on the website, splendidtable.org. consider this. Between what we eat and what we say, we as a culture cannot hide what we are. Well, that's quite a premise. But not for a scholar like Ina Lipkowitz. Now, she sees the stories behind the foods and their words, which led to her book, Words to Eat By, Five Foods and the Culinary History of the English Language. Ina, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So, Ina, these five foods, what are they and why did you choose them?
Well, I chose these five for several reasons. First, I wanted to represent the major categories of the Surgeon General's food pyramid, which is now ousted by Michelle Obama's dinner plate, but I still had the food pyramid in mind.
Right.
So that bread stands in for the cereal group, apples and leeks for fruits and vegetables, milk for dairy, and meat for protein. But more importantly than that, I was drawn to these five foods because their names are among the oldest food names we've got in the English language. People have in Britain have been calling apples for thousands of years, and leek, milk, meat, and bread have been in daily use for almost as long. Most of our other food names have come to us from other peoples more recently, but these are the oldest names because these are the foods that we've been eating the longest. And one of the main ideas of the book is that you simply cannot separate foods from their names. Food names, they don't just name food, they convey attitudes that are very specific. So just think of pâté versus chopped liver, or calamari versus squid tentacles. Or if bread were sexy enough, why is the store downstairs called Panera, you know, or au bon pain? We go to other languages.
Yeah.
We Americans, we English speakers, and particularly Americans, I think, suffer from a vast inferiority complex. On the one hand, we are so taken in by Italian and French language and food. And I love the English language. I love our English words. I think we should be prouder of our English and Northern European language and heritage. And foods. And I think it's time. I see trends in the foodie world that more and more interest is going to, for instance, simpler preparations of meat. There's a wild food movement out there going back to foraged vegetables. Very interesting. Chez Panisse put a forager on its payroll. A lot of other restaurants have now followed suit.
Yeah.
Breads are going back to less controlled, more wild fermentation. Apples are going back to heirloom, not as grafted as they had been. I see all of these trends returning us to an attitude about food that's very different from what we've had in a very sophisticated Italian and French way.
Let's talk about meat, because there's a point you make that I've always wondered about. We don't eat cow. We eat beef.
Right, that's a big one. Can you imagine if instead of meatloaf we called it flesh loaf? Doesn't, you know, would sound terrible. What we call food is matters, conveys attitude. To call it meat is to distance it from flesh, just the way to call it beef is to distance it from a cow. We don't like to think that we're eating a cow. We don't like to think that we're eating a calf or a pig. Pork from the pig, obviously, beef from the cow, veal from the calf. All those words come from French, from pork, boeuf, and veau, whereas cow, pig, and calf are all Old English words.
Yeah.
So we make it sound better, more appealing, by going to a French word that distances it from the animal. In fact, that's how I begin the book, with a story of I was moving to North Carolina for a year, and I was invited to a pig picking, which sort of horrified me, to tell you the truth, because it was this great big dead animal. You couldn't think it was a tenderloin or a pork chop. It was the whole animal. And it was called a pig picking, not a pork roast. And I think the name got me as much as the thing, because pork and roast are from French, and
mm-hmm.
pig and pick
mm-hmm.
are Old English words. There was no way I could deny what it was I was doing. But the thing was, the meat was delicious, completely delicious. And so I was drawn over to a very straightforward way of preparing it and calling it by a no-nonsense name.
There's something else that you get into in the book which seems to be a stretch, but then again it isn't. You bring religion into the picture of food
mm-hmm.
words.
Right, right. Well, religion and more specifically the Bible, because the Bible, although it is obviously popular the world over, never forget that it came from the Mediterranean. Whether the Hebrew Bible or the New Testament came from a world where fruits and vegetables grew readily, where meat was by and large not the mainstay of the diet, where milk was not drunk. And when the Bible, with the religious attitudes, moved up north, it had quite a bit of problems up north, where people happily ate meat, drank milk, and saw no reason to stop doing so. So when St. Paul told people down south, oh, it is good not to eat meat, or in another one of his letters he said something like, everyone who lives on milk is unskilled in the word of righteousness. Wean yourself of milk. Well, how are those lines going to go over up north, where people had no reason to want to stop eating meat or drinking milk? So that there were a lot of differences between the food symbolism in the Bible and food attitudes up north. And that conflict remains to this day, because people continue to eat meat and drink milk even as they read the letters telling them not to do so.
Ina, this is really fascinating. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Ina Lipkowitz teaches fiction and biblical stories in the literature department at MIT. She's written Words to Eat By, Five Foods, and the Culinary History of the English Language. Well, more is coming up. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Chef Vikas Khanna learned to cook at home as a child, and that simplicity still holds in his recipes. You can see it in his book, Flavor First, An Indian Chef's Culinary Journey. That journey has taken him into some unexpected kitchens. Vikas, good to have you with us.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you.
So, Vikas, you grew up in India.
Yes.
Where did you grow up, and what was that like?
Yeah, I grew up in Amritsar. It's a city on the border of India and Pakistan.
So it's in northern India?
It's northern India, in Punjab. We call the state of five rivers. That's where it gets its name from. It's a small city, but it's also a holy city for the Sikhs, because the most important shrine of the Sikhs, Golden Temple, is right across my house. And every temple in a Sikh temple serves free food. So that is when it got instilled in my mind that food is something much beyond feeding of human body. It's something which connects you spiritually to higher self. So that is where all my life it has been an education, something which was very practical. Like if everybody shares, there's nobody hungry in the world. But I loved that everybody would go there and donate their time, their first crops from the farms, and a whole community was created just based on sharing. So a child which grows up under those circumstances, and you grow up in a very poor home, so for you, dearth of food was never an issue. You always found abundance everywhere because people were sharing.
So how did you actually learn to cook?
My grandmother. I was born with certain kind of disability with my legs. So I would just stay home. I would not play with like normal kids and everything. So the only place where I found my center of, where I found my shelter was the kitchen, because there was something happening in the kitchen all the time. So I would sit with my grandmom in the kitchen. And she was very, she thought she found a new help, small hands, just trying to cut vegetables or, you know, peel the peas and just doing the basic stuff. But it got me so involved to the point that when she would put the food on the table, the whole family got together. I thought that was so emotional for her to see the whole family come together because of her food. And she would never be tired, she said, because she gets the energy from the smiles on the table and how you people connect. And that's the biggest mission of her life, is to feed us. And I thought that was something which was, I want to spend my whole life doing that.
What was it like for you being in the kitchen with her?
It's still the best time of my life. Still, I still every moment, every evening spent with her. Even when I go back home, we just sit in the kitchen and we talk. And, you know, and in front of her when I sit, Lynn, it's like all my masks just come off. I'm just the real, honest little kid which she raised. And I think that's so wonderful. She doesn't speak such fluently. But whatever words come out of her mind, of her mouth, it's so sacred. Few things. You have to get married. You know that. I'm dying to see your son. And it's like typical. But everything she says, it's just so pure. And it bites me to the point where I say, you know, I have to learn the way I'm with her to be with everyone.
It's that sense you can be entirely open.
Yes.
This brings to mind a project that you're working on. It's a documentary film series called Holy Kitchens, and it seems to tie into that sense of just being. Can you explain what this is?
Absolutely. I went back home after 7 years. I go back home, and my mother asked me, where do you want to eat? So I said, let's go to the holy Sikh temple. You go, you sit on the floor, and people feed you. It's no questions asked who you are, your faith, your belief, your perspectives of life, nothing. They just feed you. So I'm having that food, and I'm holding her hand, and we're both crying because I go back home after such a long time. And I tell her, Mom, I felt that I was hungry for so many years. It was a very emotionally thing for me to tell that to her, that, you know, I feel that even if my body eats, my mind is still hungry, or my, you know, there are certain needs in my body which are totally hungry. It only connects through this. And during that time after 9/11, because I came before 9/11, I thought that somebody had to tell stories about ourselves, like which I would call interfaith relationships.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that was a beautiful subject to talk about. So I made a small film on this by handy camera, and I bring it to America, and I bring it to my partner and the writer, everybody who, Andrew Blackmore does everything for me.
Mm-hmm.
He's my lifeline in America. And then we figured out that the common denominator of every faith is sharing, how we share information, how we share love, how we share compassion, and how we share food. So we started making the series. We did the Sikhism. And just now I was in Dubai, Egypt, Morocco, in Bombay, and I commissioned somebody to go to Mecca and Medina, because next year we're coming out with the meaning of what is the holy month of Islam, the fasting. Because I think that's the biggest feast on the planet, where the whole nation breaks the fast at the same time. And it has inspired me so much that I've spent almost 4 years now making that film. It comes out next year, right before Ramadan.
So this is going to be a series of how many films and how many?
Seven
films. And is this about seven different faiths, essentially?
Seven different faiths. And I thought the most interesting thing, response which I've been getting from this film, is from Ivy League universities. It's unbelievable. I just invited me to lecture at Oxford in London. And I said, guys, can we talk about cooking also? No, this is much beyond cooking. This is unique what you're touching now. And it's interesting that the government, some of the people take these films to show it in schools to create interfaith relationship, that who Sikhs are, who Hindus are. But we don't talk about religion in the films. We just talk about food. And we see the whole thing through the lens of food, which makes it very unique. It's not like a cooking show.
Yeah.
So I don't talk about how great the food is, but the whole concept of it, everybody sitting together and breaking fast or eating together, I think that's a much higher level of consciousness.
It's the thing we all have to do, and we have to do it every single day, right?
Every single day.
Vikas, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Vikas Khanna's book is Flavors First, An Indian Chef's Culinary Journey. Now, if you're dubious of turnips, I dare you to try his turnips in coconut and mustard seed curry. They're really good. The recipe's on the website, splendidtable.org. If your joy is going where no food lover has gone before and finding pure gold, a.k.a. dynamite fried catfish, then you are a kindred spirit with Jane and Michael Stern and with their website, roadfood.com. Jane, Michael, good to have you back with us.
Hi, Len.
Hi, Len.
So where have you been and what's the latest find?
Well, let me tell you, this time we're not talking about a where, we're talking about a what. And 15 years ago, if somebody said that Michael and I would be discussing this topic, I would have just thought this is the most ludicrous thing in the world. However, we're going to talk about chain restaurants, usually something that we road fooders despise, abhor, and run away from. However, there are a few restaurants, beloved restaurants of ours, that have now started springing up in multiple locations.
Restaurants that have multiplied. They may not be enough of them to actually be a chain, but restaurants of which there are more than one. The ultimate example for us is Pepe's Pizzeria Napolitana in New Haven, which was a single coal-fired oven pizzeria that made classic New Haven-style thin crust, chewy-edged pizza, I mean, the greatest pizza on earth. There are now 6 or 7 Pepe's Pizzeria Napolitanas in Connecticut, one in New York. Their kitchens are absolutely identical. They got one guy to build the ovens exactly like the original, and the pizzas are every bit as good at every one of these that we've tried. It's amazing, but true.
But how do they do this? How do they make that work?
Well, aside from replicating the physical facilities and training workers who work in the other ones at the original place, the way they make it work is that every single one of these restaurants is owned by a family member who really cares about the family reputation. So these pizzerias are not just places for a guy to make a nice living. They're representations of the family.
You have to be a genetic Pepe to,
yeah.
to,
you do a
to
DNA,
run one of these places.
You do a DNA test and then you're
exactly.
Okay. So what are some of the others that have the Stern stamp of approval?
Well, Five Guys, which is, I think, now spreading all over the country, hamburger and French fries, they do it right, too. You know, they're on a larger scale than Pepe's. But this is the burger and fries, if you've eaten there, Lynn, many, many notches up from your basic fast food place. I mean, the French fries are made from scratch, and they're absolutely terrific.
I'll tell you, the most unlikely place to ever multiply is a restaurant that we have loved for years called Doe's Eat Place in Greenwood, Mississippi. This is a funky backroom restaurant in what used to be like the worst street in Greenwood, Mississippi, but had become known for terrific steaks and garlicky salads. There are now 2 or 3 of these Doe's Eat Places, and while the physical facilities don't have that ramshackle charm of the original, the steaks are every bit as good.
Is this a case where, as these places expand, they're sending out their best people the way high-end restaurants do to run the operation?
Well, I hope so, because, you know, the fiasco with Colonel Sanders' Kentucky Fried Chicken is when he sold his name and it became a franchise, he was not a happy camper about the way the chicken was being fried. So I think whoever's idea this is to begin with has to just ride, you know, really just keep such a close eye on things to make sure that things stay exactly the way they were.
That is the key, that personal concern. I mean, as soon as you lose that, then anything goes.
Yeah. Guys, thank you.
You're
all
welcome,
right,
Lynn.
Chains, my baby's got me locked up in chains, and they ain't the kind that you can see.
Jane and Michael Stern's website is roadfood.com. Now, after hearing about that pizza place, you might be tempted to eat a classic pizza margarita. But I say, why not make your own? The recipe's on the website. Now, while you're on the site, check out our podcast, our collection of recipes, and register for our free monthly book giveaway. This month, it's our new book, How to Eat Weekends. You can find everything on that site, splendidtable.org. Bento box might take on the lunchroom just as it does every day in Japan. Now, if you've not seen a bento in action, it's like a Christmas present. You open this lovely box and there are compartments, and each holds a different colorful food, framing it, making it look special. Now, instead of a lunchbox or the cafeteria, our guest, Japanese food authority Deborah Samuels, says, join forces with your kids and make your own bentos. Now, she lived in Japan, and she raised her kids on bento boxes. Her book is My Japanese Table, A Lifetime of Cooking with Friends and Family. Deborah, it's good to have you with us.
Thank you, Lynn.
So these are the bentos, right?
Yes, the bento is inside, and I loved your description of it being like a Christmas present. Think about having a Christmas present every single day for lunch. I have the lunch that I used to make for my son, Brad, when we lived in Japan. He went to a Japanese elementary school, and I needed to send him to school with lunch. And on his first day, he went with a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, carrot sticks, a cookie, just like any good American mom would send.
Right.
And he came home crying that my lunch isn't cute. And
cute.
The lunch had to be cute. I didn't know what's cute. At which point, I needed to learn how to make lunch Japanese style, obento. And I went out and bought a book called 100 Ways to Make Obento. And my son Brad and I worked our way through the book for the entire year. And I brought his bento with me. If you'd like to open it,
Which one is the?
It's in a little yellow bag.
Oh, here it is.
And
I've got it. Yeah.
Moms every day make their children lunches. And it's not considered an onerous task. It's considered part of their job. And the job of the mother is to make a nutritious lunch that looks attractive. And the child's job is to eat it all up. And when you open the box, you tell me what you think. What are you
seeing? Well, the box, first of all, looks like the back of a Volkswagen.
Exactly.
It's aquamarine blue. It's plastic. It has, oh, I see. This is a compartment for chopsticks. On the top.
Yes.
It's plastic.
Uh-huh.
Oh, my goodness. What you've done here is there's little bits of broccoli that are around chunks of yellow and white cheese.
Mm-hmm.
There's a little tag in here with little wieners that says good luck.
Uh-huh.
There's raw vegetables that are cut in very fancy shapes. There's a big wedge of apple.
Cut into what shape?
It looks like the shape of a snail.
A bunny.
A bunny. Oh,
yes,
my goodness.
It's an apple bunny. That is the ubiquitous apple bunny in every Japanese child lunchbox. And that's what moms learn how to do.
And then there's a tomato, a small tomato with a cap on it. You've hollowed it out and put tuna salad in.
Uh-huh.
There's a wrap sandwich that's cut. How long does it take you to do this?
Well, that's a very good question, because if you prepare ahead of time, basically what you're doing is an assembly project. Bento is all about preparation and good leftovers. So I did prepare things the night before or several days before, and then you're just kind of like picking and choosing what you want to have in there. And presentation is really very important.
Right.
And it doesn't matter whether it's for a 5-year-old or for a 50-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot about the looks. Japanese eat with their eyes first. And actually, so do we as well. The other thing is that there's no plastic wrap. There's no bags to throw away. This is your original green lunch.
It's interesting.
And so that is really a big part of it as well. It's called Eko Lunch in Japan. And it's that's something else that's highly prized. The concept behind a bento, as in most Japanese food, has to do with balance and the balance of colors. They have the concept of 5 different colors: red, white, black, yellow, and green. And if you have those 5 colors in any meal, you've got a balanced meal. And at first I was concerned, am I going to be able to make something different every day for my child?
Mm-hmm.
But my son Brad really got into it, and I took on the values that were transmitted in this box. I kind of look at it as Japanese culture in a box.
Yeah.
I learned aesthetics. I learned that aesthetics were important. I learned about balance. And I learned about sort of the give and take from the receiver and the giver. It's a very, it's a cooperative relationship here.
Mm-hmm.
I used to think Japanese women were crazy for spending the amount of time that they did on lunchboxes and creating these things. But the children eat it all up, and they remember. Any Japanese person, an adult, they remember their mother's bento boxes with a lot of fondness.
Deborah, thank you so much.
Thanks a lot.
Deborah Samuels has a chapter on bento boxes in her book, My Japanese Table. Her recipe for chicken teriyaki meatballs is you know where. It's on the website, splendidtable.org. Well, the trivia challenge is up, and the question is, if the European Commission has its way, what is the up-and-coming new food? Well, we're going to be back with that answer in a moment, and you and I are going to talk. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Now, we're going to be talking to you in a moment, so get in touch. You can friend us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, shoot us an email. Just go to splendidtable.org or call us, 800-537-5252. But before we talk, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, if the European Commission has its way, what will be the up-and-coming new food? Well, the new food is going to be insects. And the reason? Pretty soon, the planet won't support protein that grows on four legs. But you have to listen to the PR, okay? At least half the world eats insects as delicacies. Insects are cheap, they're high in protein, they're low in fat, and they're good for the environment. So the Euro Commission is putting up $4.2 million for whoever comes up with a way of making bugs a popular food. That's pretty tempting. Think about the recipe contest that could come out of that.
If you're feeling sad and lonely, there's a service I can render. Tell the one who loves you only, I can be so warm and tender. You can call me. Maybe it's late, but you call me. Tell me and I'll be around.
It is time to get in touch. The lines are open. We're going to be talking to you. Anything goes. You can call us at 800-537-5252. Connect with us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. Send us an email. Just go to splendidtable.org. We have Michelle calling from Cape Cod. Michelle, hi.
Hi.
What's up? What do you want to talk about?
Well, you know, we belong to this local farm where we get vegetables every week, and now they have an oyster farm. And so we've been getting these wonderful fresh oysters every week. And I always remember going to New York City at Grand Central Station and getting one of those wonderful pan roasts, those oyster pan roasts.
Oh, yeah.
I want to know how to do that.
Oh, it's pretty simple. By the way, I wish I lived near an oyster farm.
it's very nice.
I've done, you know, community-supported agriculture, but I've never seen an oyster in the box.
Well, that's the beauty of living on the Cape.
I realize. I mean, generally, a pan roast is essentially where you scrub the oysters, you know, the shell, and you put them in a pan, and you cover them, and you can have other things in the pan, but essentially you're roasting them until they open.
Hmm.
Now, what do you remember it as being?
Well, at the Oyster Bar in Grand Central, it's in a cream, kind of a spicy tomato cream sauce over toast.
Okay. This is where you want to have fresh shucked oysters.
Right.
Yeah. And then what you want to do is you make a base. Okay.
Uh-huh.
And you can pick your, you know, choose whatever you want. You can just take a little celery and onion and maybe a bit of carrot, mm-hmm. and you saute that. And I'd like a little salt pork in there.
Oh, that sounds good.
Just a little bacon. If you use salt pork, you want to boil it for a little bit to get rid of excess salt. Not too much. You don't want to overpower the oyster. And you would saute that until it's soft.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're using the bacon or the salt pork, you want to have it not browned, but you want to have it, the fat is clear.
Right.
And it's not really super chewy anymore.
Right.
And you have a little garlic in the pan and some bay leaf, and you want to have maybe a bit of thyme.
Can do that.
Okay. And then you'd add a little sherry, dry sherry.
Yep.
Cook that off. And then you'd add some half and half or heavy cream.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
That's how I remember it. And then you pour it over a toast, piece of a toast.
Right. You add the oysters. You barely cook them because you want them to be juicy and tender. And you have toast points. I don't know why the points. I would do them, you know, however you want them. And you pour that, put that in plates or in shallow bowls, and you pour that over it and you just eat.
I think that's what we're going to do this week.
Sounds like something people will not be able to resist.
I really appreciate it.
You are welcome.
Bye.
Goodbye. That whole idea of taking any kind of fish, shellfish or any kind of fish, and doing just a simple sauce like that, and then just slipping the fish into it for a few minutes so it's just cooked, and it could be tomatoes in that sauce. It could just be white wine with a little garlic and parsley. It's a really easy, easy way to cook fish. Well, you can call us, 800-537-5252, or shoot us an email, splendidtable.org. Kathy is calling us from Indianapolis. So, Kathy, is there something on your mind, ma'am?
Yes. My husband and I are travelers, and we also love to eat, so we've ate a lot of good food all over the world. But we ended up in Cambodia this winter and ate some seafood cooked with what they called Kampot pepper. And we were actually in the Kampot region of Cambodia and saw these pepper, I guess, plantations. So it was delicious. And we bought some, and I thought, well, surely when I get home, I can look on the internet and get some recipes.
Right.
But it didn't work that way, so I have a lot of Kampot pepper, but I have no idea what to do with it.
What does it look like?
They're the actual peppercorns, and they're white, red, and black.
What do they taste like?
Boy, it's a real pungent, aromatic flavor, the black pepper. I haven't actually broke into the white and the red pepper yet.
Yeah.
Because I don't want to break the vacuum seal until I know how to use it.
No. I understand. Yeah.
But the black we use really in every day, just like any kind of black pepper, but it just has a different flavor. It's very spicy.
I think what you want to do here is think of it in terms of pepper on steroids. Because you're probably, first of all, getting fresher pepper than any pepper you've ever had.
Right.
The pepper we generally get has probably been around, been shipped, you know, been sorted, been processed, been gosh knows what. And if nothing else, maybe it never was this good to begin with. But if it was, it was so long ago that the chances are that that's diminished just with time. But I'm thinking, now, what kinds of dishes were you eating?
Mostly it was seafood that they used. And they made this like a dip with lime and salt and the Kampot pepper. And usually it was the black pepper.
Oh, that sounds so
good. And maybe a little olive oil in it, maybe.
They had olive oil.
Yeah, well, I don't think it was what we would call olive oil, but it was kind of an oil.
It may have been coconut oil.
May have been, because we ate a lot of dishes that were cooked with coconut oil.
Yeah, I would not be surprised if you couldn't make that dip and brush it on things you're grilling and use that pepper. Crush them and use them in that same combination, but use them to rub on things before you cook them, or use this as a dip afterward, or use this as a finishing drizzle on things. That combination on rice would be fabulous.
Wow, I never thought about that.
You know, think about that. Or on rice noodles with a little bit of green papaya tossed with that.
Mm-hmm.
That could be really wonderful. And also I'm wondering about what would happen if you made that mixture and you added a little bit of the, you could use just brown sugar, but there's also a palm sugar you can get in Asian stores that you could balance that against the lime. And that could become either a sauce that's on the table that you use for whatever you have on the table, or it could become a dressing.
Hmm.
And then the other thing is, I would use this as your pepper that you use in cooking, but I would make it the dominant thing in a dish, whether it's a Western-style dish or not.
Okay. What about with vegetables?
Absolutely. Imagine that you parboil kale and then sauté the kale with olive oil with that pepper, warm the pepper in the olive oil, toss it with the cooked kale with maybe some pickled onions.
Ooh.
Green beans could be done that way. Oh, you know what would be wonderful done that way? Sweet potatoes. Lightly boiled yams. you know, so that they're tender, but you do them thin slice. Something sweet played against the pepper could be delicious.
Okay.
But let it be the star, because you're not going to have a lot of it. You're not going to have it forever. So really let it dominate. Don't use it where you're going to use a lot of other ingredients.
Okay.
And that's always a good idea with any spice that you really like and that you're not going to have forever.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's almost worth a trip going back to get it. It's that good of pepper.
Well, I would go for the food, and I would certainly get the pepper.
Well, and they made this one dish with crabs, and they're the small crabs that you eat, you know, with your hands, and people came from all over just to eat this crab.
A famous, it probably carries over, but famous dish in Vietnam of a butter black pepper crab.
Oh, my.
It's just unbelievable. Kathy, give it a try.
Thanks so much.
You are welcome. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Shoot us an email. Just go to splendidtable.org or actually phone us, 800-537-5252. Matthew is on the phone from Columbus, Ohio. Matthew, what is on your mind?
Doing?
I'm doing fine. What do you want to talk about?
Well, every October, my partner and I host a marathon party because the marathon runs in front of our house here in Columbus.
Uh-huh.
And we always do the same generic stuff, eggs, sausage, hash browns. We do some croissants with different selections of meats and cheeses.
Right.
And some bagels. But they start running by our house around 7:15 in the morning. So I don't have a lot of time to get other things prepared. I was wondering, is there something that you can think of that I can prepare the day before that's kind of festive,
right?
But yet I could still serve it the next day?
Well, you know, I've got to put on my thinking cap. At 7:15 in the morning, I usually want something pretty light.
Okay.
Yeah. And you know what I'm wondering? How about going a Middle Eastern route?
Okay.
Now follow me on this, okay? How about you get some really good whole milk organic yogurt? You know, it comes by the quart, right? You know, 32 ounces, right? You get a how many people do you have over?
Usually between 40 and 50.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so it's a decent-sized party.
All right. Okay. So here's the deal. This is what you're going to do. First of all, the idea is you're going to make kind of a yogurt cheese, and that's really easy to do. You just take that yogurt. You line some colanders, you know, or sieves with a thin towel, cheesecloth, anything that's very clean, obviously, and pretty porous. And you want to drain it overnight. So this now thickens the yogurt. And right? Okay. Now, you can put that out, and then you can have all these different toppings.
Okay.
So you can have honey. You can have chopped pistachio nuts. You know, you can just buy the salted pistachio nuts.
Right.
You could have almonds. You can have cucumbers. You can have, like, relishes of hot chili, cucumbers, and fresh mint with garlic and lemon.
Oh, that sounds great.
I mean, that's just unbelievable. You have pita bread. You have flatbreads. These are things you buy. Okay?
Wonderful.
And, I mean, keep it as cheap as you want to. You can get that lavash bread. You know, you're in Columbus. I think you're not going to have a big problem getting
right.
some of this stuff. But you know that big cracker bread?
Uh-huh.
You know what I'm talking about? That cracker bread, you put out big wheels of that in a basket. It looks like $1 million. But then you show a few of them just on the table broken so people get the idea, hey, this doesn't have to stay like this. And you can put the yogurt cheese. You could have bits of pepperoni, you know, on a board or salami and whatever. The idea is the yogurt cheese is the base. You can put it in a bowl and you can do honey over it and cream, or you can pile these things on it, or you can put it on something and it becomes like a spread. So that's one thing right there.
That sounds amazing.
Yeah, and that's where you know, all you're doing in the morning is assembling it. And there's no cooking that you're doing.
Right.
And then what you do is you have big pitchers of fruit juices. And one of the things that might be fun to do is to borrow a drink from Mexico. If you've got a place that sells teas, they might have dried hibiscus flowers.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah, we have plenty of this.
Okay. Dried hibiscus flowers in Mexico are called jamaica. And it looks like the word Jamaica. And essentially, you brew them into tea, right? They're tart and fruity. And you mix in sugar while it's hot, so it's sweet tart. and you make a big picture of this, it is the color, it is crimson like you would not believe. It's so beautiful. And you take that, you put ice in glasses, you pour that out, you put a couple of wedges of lime around. It is the most refreshing drink you could imagine. And you water it down, essentially. So that would be, you know, you'd have orange juice in pitchers. You'd have that in pitchers. Maybe you'd have some pineapple juice in pitchers with chunks of pineapple stuck on it. And then you can have, you know, the wine and the beer and that kind of thing out there.
Right, yeah.
And everybody helps themselves. And then if you want to have, you know, the sweet stuff, you could have little pastries, too, that people just finger things that you could be getting at the same place you're finding the lavash and the pita.
Yes, very nice, very nice.
And you're not doing a blessed thing. And
yeah.
It's, and it's, no, but it's a completely different kind of theme, and it's kind of light, and it kind of feels like autumn, and it's really delicious.
Right, it sounds wonderful.
Yeah, okay, you're off.
Okay, thanks a lot.
And after this, they actually may want to run a few laps of the marathon.
That's what I'm saying.
A block or two.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, Matthew, take care.
Okay, you too, bye-bye.
Bye. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. And until next week, let me leave you with this thought from Irma Bombeck, who said, "I'm not a glutton. I'm an explorer of food." The Splendid Table is produced by APM, American Public Media. Take a look at splendidtable.org for additional information on anything you heard here today. Register for our monthly book giveaway. Visit our online store. Check out our Key 3 series. You're going to find everything, you know where, at splendidtable.org. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Jennifer Larson. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Andy Cruz. Sally Swift is our managing producer. We're going to be back next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.